You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
There's nothing in your life that's not contained in that music, man. He said, love, honor, duty, betrayal.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we have a special second part of our two-part series about the new Broadway musical, Holler If You Hear Me. This week, we talked to the show's writer, Todd Kreidler. Todd took the songs of Tupac Shakur and wove a story around them that deals with the issues of today. Before his time with Holler, Todd had a long career in the theater. He's best known for working extremely closely with the great playwright August Wilson. I spoke to Todd, much to my producer's chagrin, over the phone, just as Holler was about to go into previews. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL72. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's our talk with Holler If You Hear Me playwright, Todd Kreidler.
I was curious about a couple things. One of the things, just generally, before we get into specific lines, you know, I saw the show in previews and I noticed, you know, details in the story that came, you know, often directly from songs. And so I was curious about that process. If you were like, oh, I want to use this song, so I have to include, you know, a Cadillac or a mailbox or whatever, or if that kind of grew out of the writing process, like how exactly that happened.
Yeah, I appreciate that you picked up on that, because probably the only thing I knew going into this when, you know, 4.5 years ago when I got a FedEx box with 23 CDs and a book of poetry and go write a Tupac musical, I didn't know anything. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't have an archetype of the story. The only sort of operating principle I had was I knew that the story had to come from within the lyrics. You know, like I always set myself the task that I didn't want to like lay out a story and then cut off Tupac to fit in it. You know what I mean? I wanted it to come from inside out. So very early on, I immersed myself not only in listening to all the material, but I printed up. I'm a text guy, so I printed up two massive binders of lyrics and poetry, and began to work through it like Shakespeare. And so early on, I was just listening for voices, listening for different characters, listening for things that might be story. Anything that might kind of pop in a totally unorganized way, like without panic or pressure, sort of trusting this process of working inside out that a story would begin to emerge. And so I did that for about 4 months, and I began to hear, I began to hear more archetypal things, like, oh, this is the voice of a militant, this is the voice of the hustler, this is the mother's voice, you know, this is a woman's voice. You know, it was kind of general at first, and then it got more and more specific, and actually the story glue for me was actually Thug Mansion. It was like, I remember one day, and I think I was at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport in Atlanta, and it came on, you know, I forced myself to put all the songs in a playlist and listen to them and shuffle, you know what I mean, because I didn't want to fall in any patterns of thought. Like, I didn't want to listen through an album sequentially, or I didn't want to listen to a certain period of his work at a certain time, you know what I mean, I wanted to just keep, like, throwing myself and just going with wherever shuffle took me. And I heard Thug Mansion, and as soon as I heard the guitar, I just had this image of these three guys in a fire, and the first thing I knew about the story was that at that moment in the show, an estranged friendship would be repaired and a new friendship would be born, you know, and that was like, that was the first piece of what you saw in terms of how the story grew. And then, you know, if you look at Thug Mansion, there's some key story points there. He says, watch my daddy scream peace while another man shot him. So I was like, oh, what the fuck happened to him? And like, so I put that as a question. I said, what the hell happened to his father? We were in peace, you know what I mean? And so I began to lyrically, like, I treated the lyrics as like monologues or as things the character said. So then they just prompted questions like, oh, okay. So what happened there? Or where, you know, where did this idea and attitude come from? You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but that's how, tried to weave the piece together.
Yeah, I actually had that specific line that you talked about, you know, daddy screamed peace while another man shot him. That kind of, the whole backstory of John's father seems to have sprung from that line. Is that kind of how it went down?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without a doubt, you know. So I just, again, I just do that. And again, I have this, you know, I have this kind of faith in process, you know what I mean? And my sensibility is to write, you know, whenever people start, so what do you write about in general, blah, 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 blah. The best answer I can come up with so far is that I like to write character-driven American stories. So that's what made this approach also exciting to me, because if these lyrics were going to be somebody's characters, then I would build characters out of the lyrics. So, you know, even the material, the comedy material, like, if you look at one aspect of characters, their ideas and attitudes about the world, well, then I use the lyrics to express their key ideas and attitudes, and then I had to build a life and, you know, but sometimes, of course, I had to fill the backstory. The song didn't always give me that, but I try to piece it together that way, as opposed to like, oh, I got to make a character do this, and so I got to sort of shoehorn Tupac into that. I try not to do that.
Yeah, and one quick thing, I noticed there were a few minor adjustments made to the lyrics, mostly, you know, and I was curious if you could talk about that, particularly in California Love, where you take out, you know, the mention of Dre's name. Like, was that difficult to do?
Not really, because, you know, the whole point of this was, what I was trying to do, and I always use the title dialectically, that I was trying to take the music from Holler to Hear Me, and you know, I'm trying to do something that, you know, we'll see if it plays out, but I'm trying to embrace and honor the fans of this work, with which I include myself, and but also sort of bring new people to it. And I thought that from the outset, any of that East Coast, West Coast, any sort of reference to the rap game or the rap world in general, and just takes us into his biography. It takes the music into him up. It takes them into that story, which a lot of folks know really well. And I think it derails trying to get inside of the lyrics to me. So I decided, you know, Dre is not an off-stage character in our piece, and nor is Tupac. You know what I mean? So, like, even the lyric that I, you know, cut, the great lyric from Keep Your Head Up, you know, I mean, I had to cut his personal reference out, because, like, they're not characters in this world, if that makes sense. So, basically, the only cut, I mean, I treated the material like Shakespeare. I worked very, very, very hard to not cut anything. But the only minor adjustments I made, for the most part, was any sort of biography, and then anything that set us, like, in the 90s, specifically. You know, like, mentioned the Dan Quayle and Holler, mm-hmm. And stuff like that. But I wanted it to take place now. And, you know, there's a little adjustment, and I get around where I don't know why your girl keeps texting me as opposed to paging me. So there's, you know, those little things. But yeah, I figured you hear Dre, and then it just opens up. I think it breaks the spell of the piece. I wanted the piece to create its own reality. Whatever it is, it sort of exists in itself. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I really noticed about the show, like you were talking about, of characters speaking to you, I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit in I Ain't Mad At You, where you kind of have, like, you know, in the original song, it's basically one of the characters kind of speaking to another, and you divide that up. I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I love that. I mean, I feel like... Tell me, when did you see the show?
It was this Sunday of previews.
Was it a week ago? Yeah, I've done a little bit of... I'm trying to think. I think I did some work on that scene since you've seen it. To try to set it up a little clearer, to get us into that number. I don't know if you're going to see it again, but I did, since you've seen it, I did adjust, not the song, the song's exactly the same, but the book scene into it. I always had that song. I think when I told you, I always knew Doug Manson would come towards the end of the piece. I talked about the strange friendship coming together. So once I had that, I knew that friendship storyline, we would follow it out. Then I knew that early on, I imagined it would give us the backstory. So that we would have two guys who are totally estranged from one another in the present, but they have this past relationship. And I try to use that to give us our backstory of their friendship. And then there's even a little piece of their friendship in Changes, too. You know, I wish we could go back and play as kids, but things change, and that's just the way it is. You know what I mean? So those little hooks for me, narratively, I knew that I would tie those two guys together and bring their storylines together. So I tried to build their friendship and how long they knew each other. I used all the information I had at you to do that. And then what I love, and especially I think this song kills it, is that it's like, as I imagine, it's sort of the reminiscence brings them together, but by the final verse, man, it's like, as he dresses down Burtis, you still feel all the present tension, you know what I mean, and in the exit. So I love how narrative can bring, the words are the same, but the narrative brings a different coloring to the material, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it is in a lot of ways a pretty nasty song, and I think that this staging of that gets at it a little bit. You know, the title is pretty heavy on irony.
Yeah, totally. But also, it is heavy in irony, but it's like, I mean, I'm hoping, again, Sean, you never know. Sometimes there's a huge chasm between what you intend and what is playing, but I also hope that it's clear to an audience that you get the real see the real love between these guys too. You know, when they're playing up in the roof and playing dozens and, you know, all of those things show that they were, you know, show the closeness of the relationship, even though at present there's tension, there's tremendous tension between them.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about Dear Mama for a second, specifically like that song is so associated with one real life historical woman with, you know, an actual biography and an actual name, who also had some involvement with the show herself, right?
Oh, yeah. She's one of our producers.
Yeah. So how do you take that from being about a particular person and turn it into something about a theatrical character?
You just have to make the leap. You buy into the conceit of what you're doing, and you have to follow the whole way. Like, I couldn't work with that on my shoulders, if you know what I mean. I sort of had to compartmentalize that reality. And not to say it's not a big one, particularly the first time, where she first saw the first reading. I'm trying to think, maybe 2.5 years ago, the first time we sat down for like 3 days together. We worked through it. We sketched through the songs just to hear it for the first time. And I remember I sat like 2 or 3 rows behind her. And Chris Jackson's been in it since day one. So Chris has always done that role for all the readings, workshops, and everything. And I remember Chris afterwards saying that I got up this morning, I put on my socks, and I did not know at the end of the day that I would be singing Dear Mama, like, right in front of a finished course. It's like, and it just fucking all up. And it was, at that moment, I have to say, Sean, I was very aware. And I was also in this process, one of the, a friend of mine coined the expression snapshots of privilege, that you have these moments in life that you sort of, you know, you take these experiential snapshots, and they're like Polaroids you can look at that mark and define your life. And one of my snapshots of privilege was after that reading, because I didn't have a lot of, you know, the producers worked with her, but they'd been working, you know, Eric Moore produced, they'd been working 15 years to bring us to the stage, and I don't know what they did before me. I mean, I had a blank page and a FedEx box of CDs, but I was sort of, you know, they sort of like, you know, whenever her response to the material was always to the producers, which is quite common when you're working with a stage. And so, you know, I didn't even know, you know, I didn't know what her response reaction would be. And she was mobbed after the reading. There's all kinds of people around her. So we had a dinner afterwards, and I walked up to her. I really hadn't really talked to her, like, one-on-one. I'd just been in kind of in a group. And so I was just walking to her, and I was trying to, you know, in my list, I was trying to say, I miss you for, I'm honored. I just wanted to know I was honored to even have a crack at this. I mean, she could have said at the end of this, this is all fucked up, you're fired, whatever. And I walked up to her and I said, Miss Shakur, I'm honored. And she grabbed my face and she said, no, baby, no, baby, I'm honored. And she started crying, I started crying, and then she hugged me. And, like, I was at that moment that, like, I was like, okay. I was like, this is the fuel that I'm going to need to take this wherever it's going to go. Because this is, like, when I sat down to write this, I always say, like, my, you know, Hollywood has their four quadrants, whatever their demographics they're trying to hit. But my four quadrants were a baby Shakur, Sue Kreidler, my mother, who's a, you know, an elementary school principal in rural Pennsylvania who never heard a Tupac song until she heard our workshop. And then like, you know, your folks, the hardcore band, and then I think there's a whole other new audience who sort of knows who Tupac is, but, you know, it's just sort of an icon thing. Like, oh, yeah, I know who he is, but they don't really know the material. So those are the people I'm trying to hit with this. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and I wanted to actually, that ties into something else I wanted to talk to you about, which is his image. I think you mentioned Tupac or anything Tupac related, and people will conjure up a bunch of images, you know, the tortured rebel, the guy who shot at cops and got away with it, the guy with Thug Life on his belly, the sort of, like, you know, guy who had a bunch of contradictions, that, you know, a whole bunch of things. So did his image or his life beyond just the text of the song, did that figure into the story at all?
Not at all. Not his image at all. I did spend a lot of time, Sean, like, because you may or may not know, but in the, you know, and I'm new to the musical world, you know, this was my, I've sort of done one project before this, and then it fell apart, so I don't come from musical theater, and you know, now I have several musical projects and have a better understanding that, you know, the authors of the musical are usually the book writer, and then there's a, you know, there's the music and lyrics, and sometimes, you know, someone writes both, like Sting in the new Sting musical, he's doing music and lyrics, and then I think they have two book writers on that. But you have, you know, you have people working in the material, and so you're all telling a story together, and in my case, it was like, I certainly had a collaborator. I mean, this whole thing is inspired by him, but he wasn't, you know, he's gone. I mean, he's not here. And so what I did is I immersed myself, not so much in those kind of biography things, but as much interviews, like anytime I could hear his voice and understand his ideas and attitudes about life as my collaborator. I mean, I had to bring myself into this too. You can't help but do that. You know what I mean? I mean, I, you know, whatever, I'm there too. But I did definitely, like, not getting his image stuff, but, you know, the prison tapes, and again, anytime I could hear him talking, and I would, like, sort of have these, you know, mental conversations, or even, in an early interview, I remember him saying, you know, well, nobody cries when we die, and I remember writing my Yale tablet, they will in this music world, you know, I remember when, you know, he famously said, you know, I didn't invent Thug Life, I diagnosed it, you know, so those kind of things certainly influenced me, not biographically, but dialectically, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that stuff very much came into play. But his image is sort of this, you know, John, it's the same reason, like, when you came to that Sunday preview, and I know, particularly early on with this, when nobody, you know, before reviews are out or before anybody, nobody knows what the fuck this is, people are rolling their eyes, people, I mean, there's a million people don't know if we're going to do Cheek Line or Thug Life, you know, they don't, you know, what the fuck is this going to be? And that's also one of the reasons when you came into the theater, and you sat there, and the first thing you see is a blank stage. You know what I mean? A bare stage. So this was always, like, that conceit was, you know, the opening of the show was there from, like, day one, that it would be a bare stage, and that however this story formed, it sort of is conjured in front of you. You know what I mean? Because I was trying to, you know, you can imagine my finger beckoning you. That's what I'm trying to do, is come, you know, hear me, with this, you know what I mean? And try to leave, you know, and of course people, no, you know, nobody's going to leave it totally behind, but I wanted to start as much as I could with a blank canvas and then conjure the play out of that. And then we go back to blank canvas, you know what I mean? That's what I sort of love about the production, even if in the parlor, it's like, boom, black. And now, I don't think we used to, but now we do a traditional blackout. We have to. Like, the thing walking off is kind of cool, but it's like, the audience is just like, you just boom, blackout, lights up, they're gone, you know?
And one other kind of thing specific to this show was just the Keep Your Head Up and I Get Around medley. And I know that those two songs are often, you know, trotted out by writers as like, you know, examples of Tupac's kind of dueling attitudes towards women. And I was hoping you could talk about actually making them into a medley.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, as I said earlier, his whole thing, he's like, I didn't invent this, I diagnosed it. And, you know, whatever critics say about his contradictory, you know, whatever, I feel that he brought truth to life. Like, their attitudes and ideas that he wrote about are, you know, there's truth to them. People identify with them, people, you know, good and bad. People have those feelings, and I feel like, I mean, again, I'm not a Tupac scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but it's like, that's why I find the material so rich, and it's why I feel he's like Shakespeare, because there's a whole universe inside this music. There's all these different voices and different things, and they're competing, and I guess the opportunity for this show is to sort of take the eye out of it, sort of try to, like, okay, this is all contained in his head kind of thing, and just show that he's absorbing and generating into art and communicating things that are around him and what he saw and the world that he saw. So those two numbers are a perfect example to take those two seemingly contradictions, and it just magic works beautifully. Even when in the song, like Corinne has the line, you know, well, I know when the brothers from around the block, brothers like they file a lot. You know, that whole thing just characterized what we just fucking saw. You know what I mean? So I love how those two numbers talk to each other. You know what I mean? That was what it was. It was like, if anything I'm trying to do is just, you know, it's like, I mean, it's genetics, it's the block talking to each other, but then I hope on a larger thing, it's like, it's getting the audience to talk to each other. It's what I love when our houses are really mixed, because then you have different audiences, and they're responding to different things in the piece, and that's teaching the audience, you know what I mean? There's sort of affirmation to certain truths or observations, and so, you know, I don't know, I'm rambling, I'm now, but I don't know if that makes any sense, but that was one of my favorite numbers, the way those two songs came together.
Rap Genius.
If you had to choose one, either, you know, either as a dramatist or just as a fan, if there's one particular Tupac lyric that you might consider a favorite, and why?
Oh my God, one lyric. That may be impossible, you know, and I don't mean to be so evasive. I mean, certainly I was guided by the piece, you know, and the ghetto gospel that we sort of distill at the end, and we have him come forward. So that definitely guided the writing of the show. But in terms of favorite, it's hard. There's so many, you know, also too, Sean, it's like, I keep hearing new stuff. You know what I mean? I've been living in this for 4.5 years, but even now, like, I still hear new things or new lyrics. But the other night, I was, like, surprisingly moved at Doug Nancy when he says, they'd rather have us locked up in chains. Please explain why they can't stand up. You know what I mean? Am I a victim of things? You know, that whole thing, please explain why they can't stand us. You know what I mean? Like, I was just, that just caught me. You know what I mean? And maybe that's something you would say as well. That's a lyric. But, like, emotionally, that popped out, I think, whether it's in the context of the story or it's Saul or I don't know what it is. But that's hard, man. A favorite lyric. Oh, my God.
That's fine. I'll let you slide on that one for now. Maybe.
I appreciate it, Sean. Yeah, I mean, it's so rich. You know what I mean? And it's hard.
One dramatic choice that I thought was cool was, like, the biggest kind of enemies in the show, the rival gang set up as sort of enemies to the protagonists. You never see them. So what was behind the decision to keep them hidden and to make them so young?
Well, I was interested in I try to work, again, this is just sort of the toolbox I use. I try to work with a lot of nested stories. So there's a lot of, like, stories within stories. And one of the nested stories of this, of course, is the cycle of violence. So you have generationally, you know, within this community, it's like, you know, because of the mortality rate, particularly of the men in this world, it's kind of like you've got John and Bertus and even Corinne are kind of a different generation than, like, Darius and Anthony. And then even younger than them, you have the 4 or 5. You know what I mean? You have all of these. I mean, even so, we're only talking 4, 5, 6 years. It feels like generations in this world. And so I wanted, that's one of the reasons I wanted to be so young. And I don't know if you saw the show, Detailed Missing. I missed it, but it held up the show. But I also missed, how the 4 or 5, their sort of origin story, that, you know, one of the kids was killed by the police. So the 4 or 5s aren't. They don't name themselves after the 45, you know, they adopt that as their iconography, but it was really like 5 friends from middle school, one of them was killed, and that sort of was, you know, that was their defining, the way they marked themselves, and the way that the cycles, I mean, I think it's very much, the cycles in these communities, and for me, the question always was, in what way... It's not only John, but the circumstance. In what way are they America's Frankenstein? You know what I mean? Like, we all think about, especially in America, it's all about individual choice or whatever, but, you know, all you have to do is look at our, you know, rate of incarceration, and you have to say that either these young men are criminally bent. You know, you just say that this, well, okay, African-American men are just, you know, there's something in them that makes them criminal, or you have to say that, you know, because of endemic poverty and systemic racism and the legacy of slavery, they are criminalized since they're 5 years old and go to the candy store to get a Twix bar, you know. So I happen to believe the latter. So that was the sort of thing I was trying to... I know I'm all over the place now, but that's the kind of thing I was trying to wrestle with and bring to light. So I also wanted the conflict in the piece, and the same reason I did want to tell the Tupac biography. I feel like once you get to the East Coast, West Coast, and, you know, whatever, you get a lot of conflict and you get all of that, but I feel like that bubbles over and distorts what he's really writing about. You know what I mean? To me, it's like, okay, yes, he wrote Hit 'Em Up, you know, but it's like, but he also wrote, he also wrote Thug Mansion, or he wrote, you know, Holler If You Hear Me, or he wrote Keep Your Head Up, you know what I mean? So I was trying to bring life to that material. And I felt that if I brought those guys on stage, then part of me says, oh, I've seen this before. I know what this is. So then there's two conflicting things, and it's about warring gangs. And I was more interested in finding the conflict within the characters and finding the conflict within the love story, within the friendship, within, you know, Anthony, who's looking for, you know, kind of a classic story, but it's, at least it's moving to me that, you know, the whole piece, you know, he's searching for the leader that he has to learn to become at the end. You know what I mean? So things like that I found more compelling than just, okay, then we got the other side. And I don't know, it didn't interest me. I mean, some people come out and say, okay, well, that's a big flaw of the piece. You never, where's the action? Where's this and this and this? And I'm very much aware of that. But I don't know. I just think it makes it a more exciting way to get into the lyrics and to tell a story and to humanize his characters that I think are, you know, a lot of society either criminalizes or they don't even notice them, or they're, you know, they're the great, you know, fucking underclass and forgotten in America. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you worked with August Wilson for quite a while, right?
Absolutely.
So I was just curious about, you know, since you worked so closely on his, you know, his one-man show and all of his cycle of plays, what relationship, if any, do you see between his work and Tupac's?
Oh my God. I see a lyrical love for community and a lyrical love of people and in this, what I want to say is this like willingness to expose. It's willingness to expose humanity in all of its ugly and beautiful ways. You know what I mean? I mean, both of them are like, you know, August has written some of the, I mean, again, I, I, I of course am very biased, but I do think August is our American Shakespeare in terms of the richness and complexity of these characters he's written. And I think Tupac, even though he wasn't writing characters, he lyrically is in that same kind of role. So I feel them very much, very much tied to one another. And August, you know, of course, in my life, there's not a universe in which, you know, I write Holler If You Hear Me without, you know, my relationship with August and then relationship with Kenny. You know, there's sort of like a road that's full of, you know, unlikely twists and turns, but somehow, at least to me, it seems like, well, this kind of makes sense, even though, you know, frankly, I was resistant to this at first, you know, when Kenny called me and said, man, you know, the time I'll do this Tupac musical, I think you should answer, really, me? Like, I'm the first guy that pops to mind, and he said, no, man, I think you can, like, come at it and pull up these lyrics and you know, fuck with people's idea of what they think Tupac is and stuff, blah, 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 blah. So Kenny had a big hand in sort of, you know, coaxing and encouraging me to do something which, as you can imagine, it's fucking terrifying.
Rap Genius.
You know, I mean, listen, what we do, you know, putting ourselves on stage, it's always fucking terrifying. And now it's like, I'm, you know, it's fucking Tupac. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, you're dealing with a character. Yeah, you're dealing with a person where, like, you know, grown men have tattoos of them, you know? Like, it's...
Absolutely, man. And it's like, he's an icon. Well, it's deservedly so, you know? And it's been that, so whatever will and daring and, you know, whatever I've had to do. I mean, and it was Kenny, too, because early on, Sean, I was like, I think I wrote it much more like a, I always say 80% of this was written in 4 months, and then the last 20% took me 4 years. And that 80%, like, which were mostly the numbers that you know, how are in the show now and the way that they're arranged, but there was very little, you know, there was a very little book, there was very little, I was just trying to lay on all the lyrics and whatever, and Kenny's like, man, you gotta go for it. You gotta write these people. You've got to. If you don't do that, it's gonna feel like a very well put together Tupac collage or Tupac thing. You know, you've got to activate these characters. We gotta hear them. We gotta hear them in book scenes and stuff. So I definitely had a support system too, because it's, you know, the prospect of it is, you know, it's so big, I don't even think, I mean, I certainly can't think of it now. I might, you know, after Thursday, I might start to dawn on me. But just to do it, I just, you know, I had to put my head down and, you know, and do what I do and trust that. And all we say is that unlikely and as strange as the relationship between me and Tupac, I think the relationship between August and I, who was, you know, twice as old as me, he was a world-renowned, you know, writer when I met him, and I was, you know, a rural white kid from Pittsburgh, you know, who met him as his assistant and became his dramaturg, and, you know, we also became, you know, very, you know, we had a very close and deep personal relationship, too, so it's, I feel like there's no way you get to this without August Wilson, without Kenny Leon, you know, just, that's the path.
Yeah, That's pretty amazing. So now, in, you know, once this is opened around the world, I read you're working on a very different kind of pop music related project, working on something with Nikki Sixx.
Yes. Can't hit me now, man. Kind of put me in a box. You know, so I feel like I'm having the career I always dreamed in the way I never imagined. You know what I mean? This is not, You know, I mean, to be honest with you, but I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, although I was Delco, so I grew up in rural Pennsylvania, so the way people dream of coming here to New York, like, to me, that was Pittsburgh, because I couldn't think of any place bigger. That was such an enormous leap that, I mean, New York was basically the day parade. New York didn't even register until I was, like, 19 or 20, and so I was trying to get to Pittsburgh, and then I started writing, I got involved in community theater. And my early heroes were Tennessee Williams and August Wilson, you know, because, of course, August had a lot of spotlight from Pittsburgh. And, of course, I found out he's, you know, was a, you know, nationally and, you know, world-renowned writer. So I sort of always imagined myself, well, that's what I'm talking about. This is way before I even, met August, or, you know, to be clear, you know, our early relationship is very much Mr. Wilson. You know what I mean? It was very, it was hard to shake my lips to August, you know, even though, I mean, it's funny where life goes. Of course, my son's named after him. And, but for Mr. Wilson, in his place, I wanted to write these plays and do them in the regionals, maybe take them in New York. But that time I'm like, ah, fuck Broadway. It's a crass commercial, you know. Who gives a fuck about being on Broadway? I mean, that was my early army jacket, you know, Marxist tract writing sensibility when I was 18 or 19 years old. And I really didn't think much of musical theater. And, you know, so I sort of, now I find myself like, even with Nikki, like the first time I sat at Nikki's house, I said, Nikki, I gotta be honest with you. I said, man, I hated your music growing up, man. I said, your band used to throw rocks at my head and call me a punk faggot. And I said, I was like listening to, you know, Lou Reed and the Sex Pistols, and you know, I was a punk kid, and Ramones. And he's like, did you ever hear a cover of Anarchy in the UK? And I said, yeah, like a week ago when I got ready to meet with you. And he goes, I was trying to reach you. And I said, well, you missed me then, but when I read your memoir, The Heroin Diaries, I said, you got me. And I was knocked out by the writing in The Heroin Diaries, and then you know, the concept album that he's doing with the Shazam band. So I feel like, I don't know, I seem to get energy from a lot of unlikely projects. I'm like, okay, what's next? Like, you know, and I'm not really joking. I said, okay, Taylor Swift. What do you want to do?
Totally. I know, I'm sure you're a busy guy. You have one or two more things if you have time. Is that cool?
Yeah, no, I'm having fun. Thank you. You woke me up, so I appreciate it.
Okay, good.
My mind's had like a buzz and a cloud on it, so I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
Good, yeah. I had one question about, like, the songs and poems that you use in the show, right? Some of them are the super famous ones. Obviously, you know, the Dear Mamas and I Get Around and Keep Your Head Up and so on. But some of them are a little more obscure. Some of them are posthumous. Like, I was just curious about your, you know, A, like your kind of process of choosing them. And also, like, was there one that you chose that, you know, surprised you or surprised people, you know, involved in the show? Like, where'd you come up with that one?
Oh yeah, I've gotten that a lot. Like Resist the Temptation, I put up the Mother song. That was not a track a lot of people knew. I'm trying to think other ones that have popped out as unusual to people. The way that What's Next is used, you know. I also think, like, you have to understand too, there's about 40 songs that did make it, and there's even, you know, at one point Blasphemy was in the show, and I mean, it had to be cut, but it was never in the Broadway production, but it was in the workshop last year, and I just love that song so much, and I used it as a song between Burtis and Anthony, you know, in the scene where he dresses him down. He says, "What are you wearing Benny's jacket for?" You know, what war are you fighting? And he says, "I'm in the army of new revolution. Ain't every revolution supposed to be new?"
Yeah,
that scene.
Yeah,
that would lead up to Blasphemy, the song, and so you would get Burtis with his Hustler's Credo, you know, keep your enemies close, watch your homies, all that stuff Burtis had. And then Anthony had all of the stuff about God and the crime when the Pope died, you know, all of that material was Anthony. So it's still, that stuff is still in Anthony, it's still in his character.
Rap G's.
I don't know why I'm talking about this. Those numbers that surprised me. It surprised people. Yeah, you know, I didn't. The only song I knew had to be the musical, and I'll tell you another story if you want, but it's Dear Mama. That was the only fact. The first thing I wrote is that I wrote Dear Mama will be in this musical. I can tell you why.
I'm curious about that. Why was that the central one?
That was the first, when I got that CD, and I said, oh, fuck, and like, I'm like, I really got to do this. I wrote that because, let's see, I started writing this in March of 2010. And so if you go back 9 years from that moment, you go back to the summer of 2001, so that's 13 years ago, and I'm here in New York with August Wilson during his play, King Henry II, and I have been on the road with him. You know, we've done seven productions regionally. I packed all my stuff in storage. You know, I was making almost no money, but I'm like on the greatest adventure of my life, and you know, we're creating this relationship, which was, you know, professional and personal. It was just heady and exciting. I'm in New York. I'm staying at the Edison Hotel. Broadway rehearsal has just begun. And one morning we're at breakfast and we're talking about, somehow, Tupac, something came up about, I think maybe they thought they had another lead on a killer, something in the New York Times. We always use the New York Times as like the platform for whatever we would discuss in the morning that would somehow organically lead to the work on the play. And so that morning it was Tupac, and he's like, yeah, man, you know, man, well, Tupac's song, Dear Mama, man, it's a beautiful song, man. He's like his mother, man, he says, even though his mother was the crack fiend, you know, she was always the black fiend, man. It's like this letter, he's talking to me, he said, man, you know Dear Mama, and I said, yeah, I said, you know, at that time of my life, like, I knew Tupac, like, radio listening to Tupac, you know what I mean? I knew California Love, Me Against the World, but I didn't know it deeply. And he's like, no, man, but it's just love, man, but you gotta listen, man, it's all about this young guy, man, and how he comes out of you. You don't know something. Well, yeah, I said, no, man, you don't know it. He, like, jumped up and he pays the bill for breakfast and marches across the street to Virgin Records, which was right across, if you remember, they used to be the Virgin Records at Times Square, and he goes downstairs, and he's not saying anything to me, and he goes and he gets Me Against the World, and he goes upstairs and pays for it. He hands it to me outside the door. I said, thank you, Augie. I look forward to listening to this. He hasn't said shit to me since, man, he since he jumped up and, you know, ran across the street. And then we're walking to rehearsal, and he stops at the Edison Hotel, and he said, where are you going? I said, we're going to rehearsal, man. This is like, you know, Broadway rehearsal. Let's go. And he said, no, man. He said, man, that music, man. He said, you got to understand, man, there's nothing in your life that's not contained in that music, man. He said, love, honor, duty, betrayal. There's a community. There's love of a people. He's like, man, man, you can't come to rehearsal, man, until you listen to that, man. Go to your room, man, and listen to that. I'll see you afterwards. And then he walked off. And so I went upstairs to my room, 749 at the Edison Hotel, and put on my Sony Discman, no iPod then. And I really, like, you know, immersed myself in listening to, you know, of course I played Dear Mama first. I played it about 6 times. And then I listened to the album 2 or 3 times. And, you know, four or 5 hours later, I walk into rehearsal. And he looks at me and nods. And then we go up in the roof and we talk about Tupac for 4 hours. And so I always say that experience, like, what I began to learn that day, that set me into the, you know, very quickly my Tupac collection grew from that. And I always say what I learned in that day is what I try to put in the musical, because I know there's an audience out there that I've encountered a lot of them who had never heard a Tupac song until my plot starts in the piece, you know what I mean? So how to give that kind of experience, you know? So when the FedEx box came, and by that time August had been gone, you know, he'd been dead 5 years at that point, and I just remember writing on my yellow tablet, Dear Mama will be in this musical. And I really thought it was going to be called Me Against the World, just because that was, I mean, I knew a lot of the material, but that album, I knew that album inside out. Excuse me. Anyway, yeah. So August sort of, you know, has a direct hand in this too. Like I said, when I sat down to start this, I went back to that day. And there's a lot of signs like that. I mean, I have, you know, my, you know, from that day on, you know, luckily sent me those CDs. I had a lot of them already. A lot of them already on my iTunes. And when the iPod came, he got me an iPod, and I basically got my then-girlfriend, now wife, one, and of course I put my music library on it. And I think at that time I probably had, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 songs, you know, at least 1,000 different artists. And she goes back in the, of all the thousands, I mean, I'm talking about total eclectic, wide range of music, folk music, country music, you know, Celtic folk songs, like, all kinds of stuff. The only thing she said is, get that Tupac shit off of my iPod. And I said, well, no, I said, you gotta really listen. I don't care. She's like, it's misogynistic, it's angry, it's violent. I said, no, I said, it's not really. I said, you gotta listen to it. She's like, no, get this Tupac shit. This is way before Tupac music blew my life. She get that Tupac shit off my iPod. So I went in and I probably had, I would say, at least 160 Tupac tracks. And so I took them off of her library and that was it. And then years later, when I started to write this, she was not a fan. She's like, I don't know why you're getting involved in this shit. She's like, I'm telling you the music. She's like, that's okay. This project will never happen anyway. You know, blah, 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 blah. So I'm like, I had zero endorsement from her in writing this. So I started writing when I was doing fantasy. I was the associate director of the Viral Fantasy. I started writing it, and you know, I was in my office, and she hear me listen to music, but she never asked, never said anything. So I'm like 4 months in, and we're packing to move from Chicago. And one Sunday morning, she says, "How's this Tupac shit going?" And I said, "Do you really want to know?" And she goes, "Oh gosh." She said, "I guess you're really doing it." And I said, "Well, I think I found it." And she said, "Really?" She said, "What's it about?" I said, "Well, you gotta hear the music." And I went and I got my iPod, and I hadn't written my treatment yet. So I had to, you know, I owe the treatment to, you know, to sort of give them an idea of, you know, if I was going to script this, what it was going to look like. And so I hadn't written it yet, but I had like 12 songs in my iPod, and I had this, you know, the basic architecture, the story worked out. And so so I plugged in my iPod to the radio, and I said, "Well," I said, "it begins with a bare stage." And I said, "And it starts," I said, "a jail cell lowers," and this guy in the jail suit, he starts to sing, and I said, and he starts to draw, and as he draws, you know, a stoop, a store, a car begins to emerge. So he draws the entire environment. I said, and then he calls this man in the green hat, and the man in the green hat comes to life. And so then I play my block, and then I start, you know, again, all the pieces that are in the original 12 songs are in the show now, and I started, like, working through it. And as I was working through it, I forgot about her because I was doing it for myself for the first time. It was the first time I sort of was going beginning, middle, end, because I'd written it in kind of collage pieces. So I kind of lost track of her, so I'm just trying to figure it out. And I'm just totally ignoring her. It must have been, you know, we went through like 12 songs, so it must have been at least an hour and a half later, and I get to the last sequence, which has always been the same. It's always been Thug Mansion, California Love, Ghetto Gospel. And I get done with Ghetto Gospel, and I sort of looked up, and I really see her for the first time, and her face is streaked with tears. She's just like, I mean, just like her face is wet. She's been crying. She goes, "Oh my gosh," she goes, "Tupac is a genius. He's like Shakespeare." And I was like, "Oh fuck." I was like, "I might have a way into this. If I can turn her around," because she so severely hated, or thought she hated this music. And that sort of was my first sniff that this might work.
Wow, that's quite a story. And it sounds like you really, you know, judging from what I saw, you definitely met the challenge of, like, getting the music across to all kinds of people. So thank you. Thanks so much for your time, man. I really, really appreciate it.
That was our talk with Holler If You Hear Me playwright Todd Kreidler. If you liked what you heard, make sure to find us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. While you're there, make sure to leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests like Todd Kreidler. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
Hello.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I'm good. Thanks for calling, man. I really appreciate it.
Our invaluable intern is Julia Hannafin.
Can you hear me okay? I'm just like outside trying to just get some air.
Our music is by Psionic.
Sure, yeah. I can hear you fine.
Make sure to join us in 2 weeks. We'll see you then, Outside the Lines.
You know, it's also something you can set up on, you know, on your computer and kind of do from home. But I figured while I have you on the phone, you know, I would get a few specific things as well.